Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of like absolute precision. It's almost like engineering.
Right. Yeah. You want it to be clear cut.
Exactly. Like you break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line, and the doctor just points and says, well, there it is. It's totally binary. It's broken or it's not broken.
It's a very comforting way to view medicine, I think. You know, we want the wound to be visible. We want it to be easily categorized so we can just apply a straightforward fix and move on.
Yeah. But then you step into the world of neurodevelopment and especially trauma, and suddenly that x-ray machine is just broken. We're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is incredibly murky.
Oh, absolutely.
And nowhere are the stakes higher, or frankly, the medical failures more glaring than when we talk about combat trauma. So if you are joining us today, you, our resident learner, we are unpacking a single deeply fascinating source for this deep dive.
Yeah, it's an article from the OOTW Journal titled From Battlefield to Breakthrough: Psilocybin-Assisted Therapy for Veterans. And it's a heavy one.
It really is. And the mission today is to explore this massive paradigm shift in mental health. We're going to uncover exactly why standard psychiatric care is failing these veterans and how a highly controversial Schedule I psychedelic is producing outcomes that fundamentally redefine what recovery looks like.
And we really need to start with the scope of the problem, because the source material starts with a statistic that it rightfully calls intolerable.
22.
Right, 22. That is the estimated number of U.S. military veterans who die by suicide every single day.
Every single day, not a month, not a year. It's staggering.
It's beyond staggering. I mean, to put that in perspective, that casualty rate actually exceeds current active combat operations, and it's a number that has remained virtually unchanged for over a decade.
And that's despite the VA spending, what, billions of dollars on mental health interventions?
Billions, yes. It really signals a systemic failure in how we approach this specific type of trauma.
Right, so let's establish a baseline here of what the current standard of care actually is. The article mentions medications like sertraline.
Yeah, sertraline is an SSRI, so a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor.
Which basically means it's an antidepressant, right?
Yeah.
Designed to keep more serotonin active in the brain to just sort of regulate mood.
Exactly. But the source points out that the response rate for combat PTSD with these drugs is only about 60%.
And response is kind of a tricky word there, isn't it?
It's very tricky, because response here just means a 50% reduction in symptoms.
Oh, wow. So it's essentially just symptom management. It's not a cure.
Not at all. The full remission rates, meaning the veteran actually no longer meets the criteria for PTSD, those hover around a dismal 20 to 30%.
That's incredibly low.
It is. And for the veterans who do see some benefit, you know, they're often locked into taking this medication daily, indefinitely. So they end up trading the raw intensity of their trauma symptoms for this, like, flattened emotional state, plus a whole host of side effects.
Which is exactly why this matters so much to you listening right now.
Yeah.
Whether you're fascinated by the bleeding edge of neuroscience or you're just looking to understand a major societal shift, this deep dive is going to completely reframe how you think about trauma.
Because we are so conditioned to think of trauma as just a collection of really bad memories.
Right, like you can somehow just talk your way out of it if you process it enough in therapy.
But the source material emphasizes that combat doesn't just change the mind. It physically, structurally alters the architecture of the brain.
Okay, let's really get into that, because to understand why the current standard of care is failing, we have to understand the physical wound itself.
Exactly. The environment of a war zone forces the human brain to adapt for pure survival. It's a biological imperative. And it does this by fundamentally reshaping three key structures.
Okay, what's the first one?
First, you have the amygdala. That is your brain's threat detection center. It's your internal alarm system.
Right, the thing that tells you to duck when you hear a loud noise.
Yes. And in a combat environment, chronic exposure to life-threatening situations trains the amygdala to become hyperactive. It begins firing at much lower thresholds. So the veteran comes home, but the alarm system stays perpetually armed.
It creates this persistent state of hypervigilance. Like
Yeah.
the brain is actively doing its job, but it's doing its job for an environment the person is no longer in.
Precisely. But that alarm system doesn't operate in a vacuum. It communicates with the second structure, which is the prefrontal cortex.
And that's responsible for, like, executive control and emotional regulation.
Right. It contextualizes threats. It's supposed to step in and tell the amygdala, hey, we're safe, stand down. But the research in our source material shows that in cases of severe combat trauma, the prefrontal cortex actually shows reduced volume and decreased connectivity.
Wow. So it physically loses its ability to shut off the alarm.
Yeah. And that leads us to the third critical structure. We have the overactive alarm, the weakened executive control, and then we have the hippocampus.
Okay, so my understanding of the hippocampus is that it acts as the brain's contextual memory center. It's like the filing cabinet that logs the where and the when of an event.
That's a great way to describe it.
So it's the structure that's supposed to tell a veteran that a loud bang is just a car backfiring in a stateside parking lot,
yeah,
and not, you know, an explosion on a convoy route in Fallujah.
Exactly. But the source highlights something truly shocking here. Under sustained exposure to the stress hormone cortisol, the hippocampus physically shrinks.
Wait, really? It actually shrinks.
It literally atrophies. The article cites clinical studies showing an average reduction in hippocampal volume of 8% in veterans with combat-related PTSD.
8%?
Yes. That is a massive structural degradation. The brain is losing its physical capacity to differentiate between a past memory and a present threat.
Okay, let's unpack this because that's crazy to think about. It's kind of like a home security system where the smoke detector, the amygdala, is permanently glued to the on position. And the wiring that is supposed to shut it off, the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus, has literally physically melted from the heat of the stress hormones. So the brain isn't just stubbornly remembering combat. It is physically locked in deployment mode.
That analogy perfectly illustrates what's happening. And what's fascinating here is that this structural reality explains why traditional treatments so often hit a wall.
Like standard talk therapy.
Right. Specifically, cognitive processing therapy, or CPT, which is widely used in the VA. CPT operates almost entirely on the narrative layer. It asks the conscious mind to rationally process and reframe traumatic events.
But if the hippocampus has physically atrophied by 8%.
Exactly. And the prefrontal limbic connectivity is degraded. You can't just talk your way into structural repair. It's like standing in front of your melted security system and trying to turn off the alarm by reasoning with it.
You just can't. You need a categorically different intervention that addresses the physical hardware damage.
Okay.
But, you know, even if we could miraculously fix that melted wiring, the article makes a really crucial point. Those structural changes, the hypervigilant amygdala, the shrunken hippocampus, those explain the fear. They explain the startle responses, the classic PTSD symptoms.
Right, the fear-based stuff.
But they don't fully explain the existential despair, the stuff that's driving that staggering suicide rate of 22 a day. To understand that, we have to look at a second, deeply entrenched, and often completely unacknowledged wound.
And that is moral injury. This is perhaps the most profound distinction made in the research. Moral injury is distinct from fear-based PTSD.
How so?
Well, classic PTSD is a threat processing disorder, right? It's amygdala-driven. But moral injury is shame-based and guilt-based. It occurs when a service member perpetrates, witnesses, or fails to prevent an act that violates their own core moral beliefs.
So we're talking about situations where someone might have accidentally harmed a civilian or followed an order they felt was deeply wrong, or maybe even just survived when their best friend didn't.
Exactly. Survivor's guilt is a huge component. And the prevalence is massive. The research estimates that 25 to 50% of combat veterans experience significant moral injury.
That's up to half of all combat vets.
Yes. They aren't reliving the event because they are afraid. They are reliving it because they feel they participated in something fundamentally unforgivable.
And neurologically, does moral injury operate differently than PTSD?
It does. The source describes it as a self-model disorder. It gets locked into what neuroscientists call the default mode network, or the DMN.
The DMN.
The DMN is essentially the brain's background operating system. It's the network responsible for our sense of self, our ego, and our internal monologue. So when a veteran suffers a moral injury, the DMN integrates that trauma into their identity. It generates this rigid, repeating narrative of being fundamentally broken or evil.
Okay, I want to pause and kind of push back on the standard of care here because this seems like a glaring contradiction.
What?
If a veteran truly believes they've committed a deep moral violation, if that shame is literally woven into their sense of self by the default mode network, How on earth is standard cognitive processing therapy supposed to work?
It's a great question.
Because CPT asks the patient to rationally reframe their irrational beliefs, right? But if you sit a veteran down in a sterile room and essentially ask them to just verbally rationalize away a deeply held belief that they are irredeemable, wouldn't that feel incredibly invalidating? It seems like a recipe for putting up massive defensive walls and just dropping out
And
altogether.
you've hit the nail on the head because the clinical data backs up your intuition completely. The source confirms that dropout rates for these standard therapies are remarkably high for this very
It
reason.
just backfires.
Exactly. The narrative is simply too fortified by the default mode network. You are asking someone to intellectually dismantle a fortress with their bare hands.
I guess SSRIs don't help with that either.
No, because modulating free-flooding serotonin might take the edge off a depressive episode, but it does absolutely nothing to restructure a deeply entrenched, shame-based self-narrative running on a loop in the DMN.
Which brings us to the breakthrough at the center of the source material, because we are looking at a dual-layered problem here. You have the mind's self-narrative locked in an impenetrable fortress in the DMN, and you have the brain's physical hardware degraded in the hippocampus.
Right.
So how does psilocybin, a compound found in certain mushrooms, tackle both of those? The article maps out three very specific and frankly remarkable mechanisms.
Let's start with the first mechanism, which addresses that fortified narrative directly. It's called DMN dissolution.
DMN dissolution. Okay.
When psilocybin enters the brain, it selectively suppresses the activity of the default mode network. The article cites functional imaging studies showing a documented 40% reduction in connectivity within key nodes of the
A
DMN.
40% drop. So the network that maintains the ego and the internal monologue essentially just powers down.
Yes. It temporarily dissolves the rigid infrastructure that holds that self-narrative in place. The internal narrator that keeps looping the phrase, "I am unforgivable," goes completely silent.
Wow.
And this creates a profound psychological opening. The rigid self-model loosens, allowing the veteran to observe their trauma from an objective distance. There's actually a powerful quote in the article from a veteran who went through this. They said, "I could see what happened without being defined by it."
I could see what happened without being defined by it. That is an incredible perceptual shift.
It really is.
It's like separating the objective memory of the event from the subjective identity of the person. It's not rationalizing the event away or pretending it didn't happen. It's pausing the machinery that forces the veteran to identify with the trauma.
Exactly. And building on that, once the narrative loop is paused, the brain can actually begin to address the structural damage, which is the second mechanism, BDNF-driven structural repair.
BDNF. Remind me of what that stands for.
Brain-derived neurotrophic factor. It acts essentially as a fertilizer for the brain, promoting the growth and survival of neurons. And the research notes that psilocybin triggers a 12-fold increase in dendritic spine density.
Wait, 12
A
times.
12x increase, yes.
That is massive. So the neurons are rapidly growing new connection points. It's a huge surge in neuroplasticity.
It creates a critical biological window. During the surge, the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex can actually physically rebuild their connective architecture. It starts to restore that contextual memory function we talked about earlier.
So the hippocampus can finally communicate properly with the threat detection center again.
Right, and the clinical results are staggering. In early trials, 67% of treatment-resistant veterans showed clinically significant symptom reduction.
67%.
Yes, with many of them completely dropping the PTSD diagnosis at the 3-month follow-up. And remember, these are treatment-resistant cases, individuals who have failed every other available therapy for years.
That is just incredible. So we have the DMN powering down to stop the narrative loop and BDNF surging to rebuild the physical connections. What's the third mechanism?
The third mechanism directly impacts that overactive threat center. The source notes that psilocybin causes direct amygdala modulation. Functional brain imaging shows that the compound directly reduces the amygdala's reactivity to threat-related stimuli.
So it essentially lowers the sensitivity of the smoke detector back down to a normal threshold.
Exactly. There's another quote from a veteran that sums this up perfectly. "I still notice things, but I can choose how to respond instead of just reacting."
You know, here's where it gets really interesting, going back to my computer analogy from
Right.
earlier.
Yeah, let's hear it.
It's like psilocybin is initiating a complete system overhaul. The DMN dissolution is rebooting a frozen, glitching operating system. The screen goes black, the software stops running its broken loop, and in that brief window while the system is offline, the BDNF-driven structural repair acts like a hardware upgrade. You're literally adding 12 times the processing power with that new spine density.
That's a great way to put it.
And finally, the amygdala modulation resets the internal thermostat. So when the system finally boots back up, it's not just running without the glitch, it's running on entirely new, healthy physical architecture.
It is the perfect lock and key solution. It fixes the narrative damage and the structural damage simultaneously. But as incredible as the science is, translating this into a workable medical treatment presents massive cultural and regulatory friction.
Yeah, the operational reality of this has to be incredibly complex.
It is. The source dives into a stark culture clash between the military population and the psychedelic experience. Military culture is fundamentally built on stoicism, extreme self-reliance, and emotional suppression.
Right, you're trained to compartmentalize trauma, suck it up, and drive on.
But the psilocybin experience demands the exact opposite. It demands total vulnerability, psychological surrender, and deep emotional expression.
Yeah, I mean, if you try to fight a high-dose psychedelic experience with military stoicism, you're going to have a really bad time.
A terrible time.
You can't just take a combat-hardened Marine, drop them into a sterile VA hospital room with, like, white walls and fluorescent lights, hand them a schedulized psychedelic, and expect them to integrate that smoothly.
You really can't. The clinical protocols have to be completely redesigned to account for this cultural friction. And the article outlines how veteran-focused organizations are doing just that. They rely heavily on peer support, for one.
Having other veterans act as guides.
Exactly. Having peers who have successfully navigated the experience reduces the stigma of vulnerability. They also utilize nature-based retreat settings to completely remove that clinical institutional feel.
And they incorporate somatic practices, right? Things that involve the body, like structured physical activity and intense cold exposure plunges, which makes perfect sense because it aligns with the action-oriented, physically demanding culture that veterans are used to.
Yes, it speaks their language.
But, the integration tool that fascinated me the most in the source material was the use of a daily ceremonial cacao practice.
Oh, it's a profound synthesis of indigenous tradition and neurobiology.
It really is. Because think about the daily life of a service member. It revolves around highly structured, disciplined morning routines. Waking up at a specific time, physical training, inspecting gear, they have a deep psychological need for standard operating procedures.
And the retreat protocols take an ancient indigenous spiritual practice, the intentional preparation and drinking of cacao, and map it perfectly onto that military need for a disciplined routine.
It's a beautiful irony, honestly.
It is, and it serves a dual purpose. Psychologically, it gives them a grounding ritual to replace the hypervigilant routines they brought back from war. But neurochemically, it is highly supportive of the psilocybin treatment.
Because of the flavanols, right?
Yes. Ceremonial-grade cacao is rich in specific flavanols that have been shown to help maintain the expression of BDNF. So by drinking it daily, they are theoretically prolonging that window of neuroplasticity that was opened by the psilocybin.
Giving their brain more time to solidify those new neural connections.
Exactly. But here's the tragic irony of this entire situation. Despite these meticulously designed protocols, and despite the undeniable clinical data, there is a massive regulatory roadblock. Psilocybin is still classified as a Schedule I drug under U.S. federal law.
Right. And Schedule I means the government believes it has a high potential for abuse and absolutely no accepted medical use.
Which contradicts the data we just discussed. Now, the FDA has recently granted psilocybin breakthrough therapy status for depression, which acknowledges its clinical potential. But pushing it through phase three clinical trials and actually rescheduling it takes years.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, a regulatory timeline that moves in multi-year phases is fundamentally incompatible with a crisis taking 22 lives every single day.
It is. The cost of waiting for full FDA approval is literally measured in daily casualties.
So what are the veterans doing? The article points out that they are simply not waiting. They are bypassing the gridlock medical system entirely.
Right. Organizations like the Heroic Hearts Project and VETS are actively funding and facilitating trips for veterans to legal international jurisdictions.
Yeah, flying them to jungle retreats in Jamaica, or legal facilities in the Netherlands, or decriminalized zones.
The veteran community is essentially constructing an underground alternative healthcare infrastructure. The demand and the desperation are so high that they are crowdsourcing a parallel medical system outside their own country.
That is wild.
And what's truly telling about the efficacy of this movement is that even the VA, which is historically one of the most risk-averse conservative institutions in healthcare, is beginning to quietly fund psychedelic research.
Wow. When a monolithic institution like the VA starts shifting its stance, it's an indicator that a massive institutional crack has formed.
Exactly. They see the 22 a day just like everyone else. They see the 60% response rates on SSRIs that don't translate to actual remission. They know the tools they've been using for a decade aren't stopping the bleeding.
So what does this all mean? We promised you, the listener, an aha moment at the top of this deep dive. And I think understanding that trauma isn't just a lingering bad memory, that it is a tangible physical restructuring of the brain that can actually physically rebuild, is a profound shift in how we view human resilience.
It is, but the source leaves us with a very grounding reminder, too. Psilocybin is not a magic bullet.
Right. It doesn't erase traumatic memories. It certainly doesn't undo the moral injury of war.
It doesn't do the hard emotional work for you.
Exactly. It simply provides the biological conditions for the brain to heal itself. The compound opens the door. The veteran still has to choose to walk through it. Mm-hmm. And the integration work, the peer support, the cold plunges, the daily discipline of the cacao ceremony, that is what builds the room on the other side.
Beautifully said. And, you know, this raises a fascinating broader implication, something I'd like to leave you, the listener, to mull over as we wrap up.
Let's hear it.
We've just spent this time exploring how psilocybin can temporarily dissolve the deeply entrenched, shame-based narratives of moral injury that are locked inside a combat veteran's default mode network. But the DMN isn't unique to veterans. That network exists in all of us.
Oh, wow. Every single one of us has that background operating system running.
Right. So, if a naturally occurring compound can loosen the incredibly rigid, fortified identities constructed by the intense horrors of war, what does that reveal about the everyday, rigid narratives we construct about ourselves?
That is such a good question.
How much of your own identity, your own self-doubt, or your own perceived limitations in life is just a conditioned pattern locked in your default mode network, waiting for the right moment to be loosened?
It really makes you wonder what else we're diagnosing or interpreting incorrectly about ourselves. Going back to where we started, when the X-ray machine is broken, maybe we just need a completely different way to look at the murky waters.
We just have to be willing to look.
Absolutely. Well, until next time, keep exploring.